Christian rock. This is WMFO Medford.
Our God is an awesome
back
God.
After Mr. Bowie sings.
It's a god awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is, well, we'll call it the big picture for now. We'll call it the moving picture. I don't know what we're going to call it. We got to call it something. But this is our weekly look at what is happening in the world of entertainment, primarily movies. But we're going to break that up a little bit tonight, talk about some Broadway. Because I do like to get down and, well, I like to get down and see some Broadway. I'm not going to be seeing any Broadway for a while. I got news for you.
You like to get down with the stage?
I like to get down with the Broadway. I did see, I don't know how much longer it's here, if it's even still here at all. But I think I said go see Plaza Suite at one point. Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker playing the couple, the three different couples in Neil Simon's 1969 play set in the Plaza Hotel in New York. I had an out-of-town tryout here in Boston and was very good. Not really a big show for the kids. just because, you know, at the time that it was written, it was very much about sort of the sexual mores and the relationship mores of the time. And it's...
Yeah, it's playing through the 22nd.
Yeah, so
you, 3 more days.
So you got 3 more days to go see it at the Colonial. And if you get a chance, I mean, this is going to Broadway. From here, this is their out-of-town tryout, and it is actually the 50th anniversary of the show. And the show originally had its out-of-town tryout at the Colonial Theater in Boston. So there's a nice little historical loop there for that. It is a wonderful production. It is a funny show. Most of the audience that was there was older when I went to see it. And I don't think that's coincidental, because this is a show that if you are of a certain age, namely 70 plus at this point, I think, it's a show that has a place in your heart. It's early Neil Simon. It's pre-Brighton Beach memoirs, you know, that whole trilogy Neil Simon. It's very good Neil Simon, but it is also very much of its time. So kind of lost on the kids. Although there's, you know, there's enough universal aspect to it. It deals primarily with love and marriage and relationships, and relationships in trouble and different kinds of relationships. I'd tell anybody to see it. There's nothing really obscene in it or anything that, you know, that you wouldn't want. I mean, it's going to go over a 6-year-old's head. But there's nothing in it that, you know, you'd be sitting there with your teenage daughter saying, oh my God, I can't imagine you're seeing this.
Yeah.
If you can get tickets, by all means, go check it out.
I'm looking right now. There are 2 tickets left.
For tonight, probably.
Forever.
Oh.
For Friday, yeah, therefore.
There's probably some floating around.
I was
going to
say,
somewhere.
I bet if you went on StubHub, you could get some.
Yeah.
But yeah, like on the Emerson Colonial Theater website, there's Orchestra W112 and 113. And they're wheelchair accessible seats. Does that mean that it has to be... You have to be in a wheelchair?
One person has to be in a wheelchair. So, That's out.
I mean, unless you feel like renting a wheelchair.
Let me put it this way. If you pay aftermarket on these, it's still cheaper than going and spending a weekend in New York. So
ta-ta.
That's your next opportunity see it.
Yeah, I'm seeing that. So, I'm seeing that.
I'm not going to say, it's not in the if you only see one show this year, go see this show category.
But it's an if you have means and occasion.
So I was all fired up to get your take on Sonic the Hedgehog, and you wound up having a busy weekend.
I wound up having a busy weekend.
Another trip down to Bye Bye Baby. We'll leave that for now.
I will say this wasn't me seeing a movie, but my mom...
Your mom saw Sonic the Hedgehog?
My mom did not see Sonic the Hedgehog. So my mom, it's funny because both my parents, people on the show know my parents aren't together, but they both have this idea that they wanted to see all the movies that were up for Best Picture this year.
Right.
And so my mom watched, I was like super proud of her. She watched Parasite and Joker over the weekend, or on Thursday. And, she said Parasite, it took a little to get into it, but that the ending, she was like, it finished, and I was like, this is why it won Best Picture.
Yes.
Joker, she was very deeply disturbed by. It was one of those, she's telling me this, like, as I'm driving home from work last week, I was like, oh, what are you doing? She goes, I just watched Joker. And I literally said, you what? She said, I just watched Joker. I was like, you what? Like, you did? And she was, yeah, my friend said it was good. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm not denying that it's good. It doesn't strike me as something that you would watch. But she was like totally playing it cool and being like, oh, you know, like he won Best Actor and I wanted to see it and everything. And I got to her house last night and she just looks to me and goes, yeah, so I did not like Joker.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that's what I was talking to her about is that it is a... one of those movies where like you're not supposed to flee feeling good.
It's not
like you're supposed to be able to appreciate that it's a great movie.
Yeah,
but you're not going to leave being like, wow, what a pleasant afternoon.
Yeah, it really doesn't have much positive to say about the human condition.
No,
it is not
or society.
It's not a happy-go-lucky story.
No,
it's.
But I had to, it was just like, it's, I always find it interesting when people see films that are, let's say, outside of their film comfort zone.
I'm in that camp of people who is thoroughly mixed when it comes to Joker. You cannot argue with Joaquin Phoenix's performance in the film. That deserved Best Actor. There's no question about it. He was amazing in that role. My problem with the film is really one of pacing.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about this.
I'm looking for the progression from Arthur Fleck, party clown, fish out of water, doesn't fit in, mental illness, to Arthur Fleck, criminal mastermind.
Yeah, like total criminal psychopath.
Ready to burn down the world. And it doesn't take you from point A to point B in a satisfying way.
See,
it almost does. Like, the story is there. They just don't tell it the right way.
See, and I'm in the camp of that. I think that was deliberate. In that, I mean, if you recall when that film came out, it was
the end of the world.
It was, yeah. There was
See this movie. There'll be rioting in the streets and all the basement dwelling neckbeards are going to stab everybody and we're all going to die. And
yeah,
then people came out and they're like, you know what? It's actually a pretty good movie.
Yeah. And it's like, no, actually it's a commentary on the fact that that's already happening, you dummies.
Yeah.
But that I think was like, you know, everyone was drawing the parallels between that film and all of the mass shootings that are just commonplace now. And I think that that was kind of the point of that you didn't see the progression because they were trying to make the point, or you saw the progression, but you didn't see a slow build, is that they were trying to make the point that it is literally just one day someone snaps. Yeah. Like, just it takes one final straw to just go from 0 to 60.
Well, we seem to have graduated from the mentally ill mass shooting to the politically motivated mass shooting in the last couple of years, which is infinitely worse.
Yeah.
You know, you can reconcile somebody completely losing their mind and picking up a gun and killing a bunch of people, and then asking the question of why do those people have guns? How are they able to get guns? And why can't we protect ourselves against this? The calculating political mass murderer is a different animal entirely, and one that, as a society, we're really not prepared to deal with.
Well, because that, I mean, there's obviously a...
Joker portrays the former, by the
way.
But
the people who follow him portray the...
This is the thing. As he becomes an avatar for the unrest and the disillusionment, he becomes this figure that inspires political violence.
Well, and that's, I think the reason that the politically driven is scarier is for the same reason that movies like Joker, and I mean, I would even go as far as, obviously, Dark Knight is theoretically still, like, obviously fictional, but it seems realer than, say, like, Batman Forever.
Nolan tried to ground those films in the real world as much as he could.
Yeah, and, like, that's why they're arguably scarier, is because it... when it's somebody like Sandy Hook or something like that, you're just like, oh, that's a person that lost their mind. No. Okay. But when it's politically motivated... yeah, the person's obviously some level of crazy, but they're, to some degree, still level-headedly thinking.
Yes.
Because it's scarier because this isn't someone that's gone crazy. This is someone who believes they're behaving incredibly rationally.
And this is one of the interesting, there is a lot going on between the frames in Joker. Because what you wind up with at the end of it is this political movement. And at the center of it is this character who is completely broken with reality, mentally ill, doesn't understand any of what's happening around him, just knows that he is now in charge.
Yep.
He is literally the lunatic running the asylum. And it's an interesting take on that character, because we always think of Joker as being this sort of, you know, 10 steps ahead, calculating, I knew you were going to do this, I knew you were going to do this, laying very elaborate traps for Batman based on everything that he knows about Batman and his complete disregard for human life or emotion or any of that. This version of Joker doesn't really seem to have any of that. And I guess if they go further with this, which I understand they're going to, you're going to have to get the character to that point now, you know, where he becomes calculating, where he becomes scheming. You see a little bit of it in self-defense in Joker.
Yeah.
But nothing that tells you, oh, this guy is going to become like the greatest criminal mastermind Gotham's ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This guy's going to turn this whole city into bedlam.
Yeah, he's at this point, he's a sociopath with a following that he doesn't understand, but that he's happy to have. You know, oh, I finally have friends, you know, who like and appreciate me. Yay.
Which is...
So weekend box office, kind of interesting. As I said, I was hoping you were right on Sonic the Hedgehog, by the way.
That it did well.
Number one film in the country, $58 million in its opening weekend. Which went above and beyond projections. They were looking at a 45 to 50 on this one. And it pulled in $58 million.
Everybody wants a piece of James Marsden, and everyone my age loves Sonic the Hedgehog.
Suffering at the hands of that was the recently retitled Birds of Prey. It's not called Birds of Prey anymore. It is Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey. Dropped 48%, pulled in $17.1 million. That's done. It actually, its total gross after 2 weeks is $1 million more than the opening weekend for Sonic.
Wait, say that again?
The total gross, $59.3 million for Harley Quinn and the Birds of Quinn.
Birds of Prey.
Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey. Is $1 million behind, or is only $1 million ahead of the $58 million that Sonic made in its first weekend.
That's
poor.
Fantasy. I was going to say, I asked you to say that again because I didn't know if I was hearing you properly.
Sonic made as much money in 4 days as Harley Quinn made in 2 weeks.
Period.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's what I'm looking for. There was, I can't find it now, of course, but there was a movement of people like trying to come to the defense of the Harley Quinn movie.
Apparently it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah,
I talked to one of my film critic friends today who his take on it was it's Deadpool without Ryan Reynolds, and he presented that as being a good thing. I happen to think Ryan Reynolds is a national treasure, and I love everything that he does.
Oh, we talked about how we both are just like, I mean,
yeah.
If loving Ryan Reynolds is wrong, I don't want to be right.
So, you know, every bit of love to Max, but Ryan Reynolds is great. Fantasy Island came in third, $12 million. I think they spent 50 cents making that movie, so that's another success for Blumhouse.
Yeah, and we talked about how that is so like the high school kid, this is what we do on Valentine's Day movie.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm going to like hug into your chest that has three hairs on it.
The Photograph, not far behind it, $12.1 million. Good box office for that.
Yeah.
Because that's a film that white audiences, to their detriment, are going to ignore.
Yeah.
If you're white, you should go see that movie.
Okay? I mean, if you're whatever, you should go see that movie.
If you like romantic movies, you should go see that movie. And if you like love stories, go see that movie.
And beyond being a romantic movie, it's like the plot is very interesting.
Yeah.
Like, it's like that's what I was saying when we were talking about this film last week, is just, it's like, yeah, there's like the romantic story, but that's not like the whole, like, that's not the point of the movie. As, you know, anything with Sarah Jessica Parker, you're like, okay, this is going to be about romance. But like, this movie is, you know, interesting plot with a side of romance.
Bad Boys for Life, man. Let me tell you something. There aren't too many movies that are going to do this. Dropped 345 theaters over the past week, right? Only dropped 4% in revenue. Fifth with $11.5 million. And has made $181.5 million since its opening. That is the first big blockbuster success of the year.
Jesus.
Coming in at number six, 1917.
I would say now we're getting into the people still seeing Oscar ones.
Yeah, so the Oscars gave that film a huge bounce, and that's made, I don't know that they ever expected this, that's made $144.4 million in the United States. For a World War I epic and arguably an art film.
I was going to say, for something that theoretically could be viewed as like a niche type of genre.
That's exceptional. Jumping up four places this week from 11th to 7th with $5.6 million, Parasite. Up 245% week over week thanks to those Oscars. And has now pulled in $43.3 million, which is a huge, huge deal for the Koreans because they don't expect these films to play at that level in this country. For everyone who's thinking of seeing, somebody approached me, or I was talking to somebody, I said, what are you doing tonight? And they were like, well, we're really going to go see Parasite, or we're going to see Birds of Prey. And I said, go see Parasite. It was PJ. I was like, go see Parasite.
This isn't even a question.
I didn't get a chance to talk about it here on the show. If you're curious about the film, and you're one of those people who's like, I don't like foreign films because I got to read the subtitles, get over yourself. Forget about the subtitles. This is one of the defining moments in cinema in the 21st century.
That's saying something.
Parasite is not only a brilliant, brilliant piece of social satire. It is a film that is very much unlike anything that you've seen before. Where you sit there and you watch it and you think you're watching one thing and then it changes into something else. And then it changes into something else. And by the time you get to the end, you realize that you were actually watching a very different movie than the one that you walked in expecting to see. It is billed and sold as a dark comedy, and it is a dark comedy and social satire. But where it goes is incredible. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It was one of my top five films of last year. I think it was probably second only to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I'm a deranged Tarantino fan.
I was going to say, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was awesome.
Yeah. If you like Tarantino films, if you like Scorsese films, you're going to like Parasite. It is a bit of a slow burn at the start, and you're going to sit there. And especially if you don't see a lot of foreign films, you're going to sit there and you're going to say, I don't care about these people. I don't care about what's going on. I'm reading subtitles. I want to get out of here. Once it gets its hooks into you, and if you see foreign films, like, you don't care, that you don't have that barrier. I think that's the problem for a lot of American audiences.
Yeah, is that they're like, subtitles?
Believe me, the slow burn at the very start of the film does not last long. And once it starts going, it's incredible. Cannot recommend Parasite highly enough. Jumanji is still hanging around. That's made $305.5 million. Doolittle has somehow made $78.3 million, proving that people will see anything. The weekend's other new film, Downhill. It's all downhill for Will Ferrell.
Yeah,
I did
not see that going well.
$4.6 million. I had some hope for that.
I skipped it all over that play. All over that film. Well, it's just, I mean, first of all, it's literally been done before. It's a remake of a French movie, but it also, like, I was bored reading the description of it. You know what I mean? Like, it was one of those movies where it's just, I was like, I'm already like, I don't see any point in me seeing this. And I feel like anyone else who read the description of it would feel the same way.
I just look at it and I'm like, everybody loves Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Will Ferrell used to be.
And nothing against them.
Will Ferrell used to open huge. His movies were all blockbusters. Mm. Wasn't that long ago that people were going to see and raving about Will Ferrell movies. I just don't think this had an identity. You know, I looked at the trailer and I'm like, is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it somewhere in between? What is it?
what do you want?
and it's like, you know, the premise is like the dad runs away when the avalanche hits the hotel. That's not necessarily funny. It doesn't necessarily open you up to a lot of ha-ha shenanigans potential. There's all kinds of jokes you can do in skiing, but there has never been a successful skiing comedy.
Is that true?
That is 100% true.
Well, I think you're right. It's like it didn't have like an identity far enough in any direction, especially with people like Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell. They can go big. You know what I mean? Both of them are actors who are capable of going very big in comedy. So it's like, if you see them in like a darker, like gentle comedy, it's kind of like, no, this isn't what I want from you.
Yeah.
this isn't what I'm paying you to do.
And it's just one of those weird things. Anyway, we've got to let in Andrew so that there will be On the Town with Mikey D in a few minutes. So we're going to take a quick break here on WMFO Medford. Derek and Shay back with more On the Movies right after this.
We'll be right back.
Doesn't matter. WMFO Medford, 91.5 FO. David Bowie, zeros.
You're in a Bowie mood tonight. I am digging it.
That actually, for those who've been listening for a long time and know their big picture trivia, that is the song that I put on after the radio show and sing along to after the show every week. So there's that. So we were talking about the weekend box office and a couple other things on here. Little Women is still showing.
Yeah, I was going to say, as we were talking about that, I was like, ooh, maybe I'll go to the movies tomorrow.
Well, that dropped from 8th to 13th, but
Little Women
still over 1,000 theaters. The one that I love comes in at number 15. Down from number 9 the previous week, Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, still in theaters 9 weeks later.
My,
still playing in nearly 1,000 theaters. Frozen, by the way, is still in theaters 13 weeks later.
Of course it is.
Because it's school vacation week.
My niece
right?
has tried to get me to see both of those with them.
Yeah. So
the answer was a resounding no.
You're going to keep Frozen around for school vacation week. But Disney is totally leaving Star Wars in the theaters just to try and scrape up some respectable box office for it.
Just like maybe people will be like bored one day.
Yeah. So
be like, oh, I guess I'll see the new Star Wars.
Sitting at $512.8 million, it's not going to go much higher than that. It did pull in $1.38 million last week. So, you know, they'll probably keep it around until it gets to 525, and then that's gone. And by that point, the Blu-ray will be coming out anyway. So, since we don't have anything new movie-wise to talk about this week, there is an embargo on reviews until tomorrow night, according to tradition. I don't think anybody's going to get too hot under the collar from somebody in Boston sharing their opinion on this, because other people have already done this. One of the big events in Broadway is going to happen tomorrow night, and that is the official opening of West Side Story.
Oh, yes. You were talking about this
weeks ago. How big is this? Well, if you saw 60 Minutes on Sunday night, they did a feature on the show. It's been written up in the Times. It's been written up in the New Yorker. It's been written up in all of the usual places where it would be. But 60 Minutes is something else entirely. 60 Minutes will, at most, do 3, maybe 4 pieces on Broadway in a year.
Yeah.
If you get one of those slots, you are a big deal. And the fact that this show is getting this level of attention from 60 Minutes and from every place else makes it a big deal. Directed by Ivo van Hove, who I have been raving about for many years now, ever since I saw him his version of David Bowie's Lazarus at the, what is the name of that theater off Broadway? My wife knows this and will probably text me and tell me. The New York Theater Workshop, which is where I saw David Bowie's Lazarus. I saw his network last year and told everybody, or in 2018, late 2018, and told everybody, go to New York and see Network now, because it was one of the most brilliant pieces of theater I've ever seen. West Side Story, then, has very high expectations from me as an Ivo van Hove fan. I am familiar with what he does. Ivo van Hove's set design, stage design, tends to be very minimalist, very geometric. This guy loves his rectangles.
I would say I'm looking at the production photos right now.
He also tends to be a big fan of lighting the show with projectors, although in this case he does not do that. The set for West Side Story is an empty stage, and there is a wall at the back of it. What you will come to realize very quickly is that that wall is a giant video screen that runs the entire length of the stage. And at varying points during the production, you'll either see close-ups of the actors who are in the middle of a scene in front of you on the stage. Mm-hmm. You may see film that was recorded with the actors. You may see film of just the camera drifting through an abandoned, downtrodden neighborhood in New York City. With a dancer who, you know, fades in somewhere off in the distance, dances for a little bit, and then disappears into the shadows again. That part of it is amazing. And there are environmental effects. It rains in the middle of this show as well, which may be why the actors keep getting hurt. We're not sure about
that. Which could explain some problems.
Now, the video wall opens up in two different places. And there are sets behind the video wall.
I would say that's where Docs is.
Right? Yes. Docs is one of them. And the dress shop.
The dress shop, yeah.
Is the other one. Depending on where you sit, and we were sitting in the balcony in the center, you're not going to be able to see the actors when they're back in these sets. Mm. If you're down close up front, you'll probably be able to see everything. But for what you can't see, it is projected on the screen.
Oh, that's such a cool idea.
And the sets, those two sets in particular, are amazing. The Doc set, you sit there and you look at it, and for us as audience members, sitting and staring at this, it's like looking at a bodega late at night from across the street.
Oh, cool.
And anyone who's been in New York knows that particular type of light that comes out of a bodega. It's very fluorescent, it's very harsh, and you can everything inside is very bright, and you can see all of that. There is also another set, which is nowhere near the stage. It's somewhere up on the third floor of the theater, which is Maria's bedroom. And that also is shot with cameras. So some of what happens right in front of you. Some of it is projected onto the screen. All of the staging is incredibly effective. There is controversy around this because West Side Story is one of the most beloved, classic, protected Broadway musicals of all time.
If ever there was something that was sacred.
Jerome Robbins choreography, sacred. Stephen Sondheim lyrics, sacred. Leonard Cohen music, sacred. Von Hove has thrown a lot of this out the window. He has converted the show from its original two acts into one act. To do this, he has thrown out the big ballet in the middle of the show, and he has thrown out the song I Feel Pretty. The dancing, the sacred Jerome Robbins choreography with the jets and the sharks snapping and all of the ballet leaps is gone. And it has been replaced with a much more physical, much more violent style of dancing that is meant to represent the conflicts that exist between the jets and the sharks. So this is not the stylized, dance-heavy, song-heavy West Side Story that you grew up with. This is a West Side Story that is about what is happening on our streets today. It is a bold choice. And I will say it is one that does not entirely work. Because the ultimate problem here is that Ivo von Hove has not changed a word of the script. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a show that was written in the 1950s about street level, an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet set in a street level confrontation between recent Italian immigrants and brand new Puerto Rican immigrants, and a city that just doesn't care about any of these kids.
Yeah.
And leaves them basically to fight it out amongst themselves. This is where the song Officer Krupke comes in. And Krupke is not played as a comic song in this version of the show. In the original version, that song exists as comic relief.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like a light-hearted thing.
It's comic relief after Tony gets killed. In this version of the show, it is a song of youth anger at their situation. And it is very powerful. The acting is spectacular. I did not get to see the actor who was playing Tony because he was recovering from a leg injury. You won't get to see the original Riff, who I got to see, because he's recovering from a leg injury. I can tell you that Maria is spectacular. She's an amazing young talent. All of the young cast in this does a phenomenal job. Great voices, great dancers. You are bought into the characters that they're playing, and you're bought into the desperation of their reality. Ultimately, it comes up a little bit short because you have that conflict between this 1950s take on what was happening and everything that we've learned since then. The show is about, the show as staged is about everything that we've learned since then.
Yeah.
But it is stuck with this script of outdated ideas.
Which, I mean, like you said, it's hard because I can see, I mean, even just with the video screen, all of that, like the desire to bring it into now while also not making a bunch of Broadway nerds and like theater nerds like super, super angry by messing with something too much.
I think it's going to be divisive. And I think people who are really, really big fans of the you know, the sort of romantic version of West Side Story are not going to like this. I think people who look at West Side Story and see it as a relic of a bygone era are going to appreciate this. But they're still going to come away from it saying there are problems here with the script. And this is, there's a big moment of reckoning happening on Broadway right now when we talk about the classic Broadway shows of the golden era, the Rodgers and Hammersteins and Gilbert and Sullivan, all those sorts of things. Because the content of those shows has become so dated and is so out of touch with modern sensibilities that you run certain risks staging them without heavily reworking things to reflect what a modern audience expects, particularly a young audience. And this
Like a 22-year-old going to this.
This is always Broadway's challenge. Broadway can pull in the old people like crazy, but if Broadway is going to continue to grow and survive, it needs to get the young. And this gets us to things like last year's production of My Fair Lady, which had a spectacular cast and was a marvelous reimagining of the story up until the final moment when Eliza Doolittle walks in, tells Henry Higgins to get bent, and walks out the door. That was the only, that they didn't change a word of the script. They just changed that and ruined the show.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
If she doesn't stay with Henry Higgins, why have we gone through any of this?
Why did we sit through that?
And to be sure, Henry Higgins was portrayed as an irredeemable pig in the show. So you would have lost respect for Eliza if she'd gone back to him.
Mm.
unless at the end he has that moment of reckoning where it's
oh my God, I'm such a jerk face and she's dope.
They gave him that moment of reckoning and then she walks out anyway. And you're like, what? Why did we do this? And I walked out of that production angry. I expect that's going to happen with this. And people are either going to deeply love it, or they're going to be like, that doesn't work. And even the people who deeply love it, I think, are going to have some problems with it. None of this is Von Hove's fault. None of this is the cast's fault. It's what happens when you take a classic that reflects the ideals of half a century ago.
I would say of a certain time.
And put a modern wrapper on it and say, here's modern theater. Well, it is in everything but its content.
Yeah. I would be interested to see it, though. I mean, like I said, I'm looking at the production photos of it.
I have it as a strong contender to win the Tony for revival this year. And I will be shocked. I can't say anything about Tony. I will be shocked if Maria is not nominated for a Tony, because she was that good.
You confused me for a second because you said Tony.
And particularly at the very end of the show, if you know what happens with Maria, the way that moment plays out is incredibly powerful. Everything that I've ever seen Ivo Von Hove do has one moment in it that just totally stops your heart.
Mm.
And you are taken with his power in the theater. And in this show, it is Maria at the end of the show. It's just amazing. So you walk out of the theater on that high, and you're like, oh, wow. You know, it is. It is a breathtaking experience to watch. It's when you sit down and think about it a day later that you're like, you know, yeah. So go see it, by all means. Make up your own mind. Divisive art is great art. And I may be wrong. People may universally love it. I'll be surprised if that happens.
That's, I mean, to be, and it, so you saw, but the official, like, open is tomorrow.
Yes. So the New York Times review will be out late tomorrow night. I think they're going to say nice things about it.
Yeah.
I'll be surprised if they don't say nice things about it. And certainly, you know, the outlets that exist just to, you know, peddle reviews all day long are going to say, oh, it's great, it's fabulous, it's so empowering, it's wonderful. But I do think it needs to be looked at in a context.
Yeah.
And that's where it falls down a little bit. I will still go see anything that Ivo van Hove does. And I cannot recommend seeing a show that he has worked on highly enough. Because he really... People have this idea of avant-garde theater. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, it's an empty stage and someone sitting on a stool stirring tea. Mm-hmm. While mandolins play in the background and an acrobat twists around.
Yeah, on those like suspended things.
Yeah. Yeah, Ivo van Hove is not that kind of avant-garde director.
Yeah, not that kind of like everyone's saying what a genius they are when they themselves don't really understand it.
Yeah, he's the kind of avant-garde director that you look at and say, why isn't everyone else directing shows like this?
Yeah.
He's a true innovator. And here's an interesting thing. I walked out of that show, and the first thing that I said was, I would love to see his version of Rent.
Oh.
And as it turns out, he directed Rent, but it was over in Europe. So we'll probably never get to see that here.
I was going to say, chances are he's not going to double down on that.
But it would be great for, say, I don't know, the 30th anniversary of Rent, which is a few years away. Maybe you bring him back to the New York Theater Workshop. And
God, is that 30 years?
Yeah, I think it is.
We old.
Yeah, because wasn't the 25th the TV broadcast last year? Was that the 25th? I think it was, yeah. Because I was down in New York for that with the Theater Workshop people.
Yeah, it was, let's see, made its debut at Off-Broadway's New York Theater Workshop in January 1996.
Yeah, they need to get Ivo van Hove to come in there and direct Rent in that theater for the 30th anniversary.
Well, so the 25th will be next year. So you must have gone for the 20th.
Oh, so next year's the 25th. Yeah, yeah. So I was there for the 20th.
God.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say is, like, I remember them talking about it on Friends. That's what I was trying to, like, have, like, the frame of reference in my brain for when Rent came out originally.
But Ivo knows what that theater can do. He's directed in there before. Oh, my God. I will give you my money now. I will. Yeah, I'll live with DYS coming and taking my child away. I will go see that. It is WMFO Medford on the Tell Mikey D coming your way in just a couple of minutes. Everything you need to know about the Boston music scene when we come back. Yes, see it, skip it, stream it. The new movies coming out this weekend. Are they worth your time? Are they better than Downhill? Poor Downhill. Wait a minute. What? That is totally not supposed to be playing right now. That's the theme for the next show. No, you didn't. You haven't missed anything.
Yeah. Just a preview.
Yes. So when we come back, see it, rent it, skip it. Everything new that's coming out this weekend, and whether it's worth your time, here on WMFO Medford.
It rests on 13 acres of earth, over the very center of hell. The last house on the left. Here is the first motion picture to offer to the daring a look into the final maddening space between life and death. The last house on the left. Caution. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Sights and sounds far beyond anything you've tested. The Last House on the Left. Offered by Sean Cunningham Films Limited in color. Caution. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Take as only much as you can.
Only a movie.
I'm Sarah, and this is my story.
I'm Ellen, and this is my story.
One night, I was at a bar.
One night, I was at a bar.
I was having fun with my friends.
I was having fun with my friends.
I had one too many drinks.
I had one too many drinks.
I got behind the wheel to go home.
I got a cab to go home.
All of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a squirrel ran across the road.
And all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a squirrel ran across the road.
It happened so quickly, I barely had time to react.
It happened so quickly, the cabbie barely had time to react.
I swerved.
The cab swerved.
I can't believe it. I hit a guy.
I cannot believe it. The cabbie just missed a guy.
I wish I took a cab.
Thank goodness I took a cab.
You have the choice to save a life. Don't drive buzzed. It's a decision you'll never regret. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. We are wrapping things up here at the Big Picture, but before we go, we have to do See It, Stream It, Skip It. We are going to tell you whether we would see it, stream it, or skip it in terms of the movies that are coming out this weekend, or the top movies that are coming out this weekend.
On the plus side, we're out of Dumpuary, which is, where all the bad movies...
It is past.
All the bad movies go to die. On the downside, I don't know. This is either a really good weekend or this is a really bad weekend. Your big blockbuster opening this weekend, Shea Spillane, is The Call of the Wild.
Yes.
Harrison Ford stars alongside CGI animals in an adaptation of Jack London's once beloved story of adventure in the Alaskan Yukon. Karen Gillan is in this movie for some reason. Bradley Whitford is in this movie. For all I know, they're just doing the voices of the... Omar Sy is in this movie. They're just doing the voices of the animated animals. I don't know. Have you seen the trailer for this?
I've seen the trailer, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I am of that age where the sight of Harrison Ford kind of melts the heart a little, and it's like, ooh, Harrison Ford, like, action movie. And I remember when those were good. And then I'm like, wait a minute. He's talking to a dog, and the dog animation doesn't look that convincing.
It's... The trailer makes it look pretty good. It is, I mean... The trailer, the way that they set it up, I was like, oh, it's like Harrison Ford and a dog. And then, like, once they start having the dog, like, interact with him, you're like, okay, no, that's not a dog. That's an animated dog.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it pushes it a little. Like, it, I don't know. I put this as a stream it. Just because
some of it's real dog and some of it's computer animated dog, and it could just be the trailer, because they sometimes the effects get cleaned up, you know, before the final release comes out. But looking at the trailer, this looks like a CGI team that is either really rushed or isn't trying that hard.
Yeah, I mean, I almost, like, that's the thing, is I almost feel like it was purposefully campy. Is that the word I'm looking for? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like,
back in the day, they'd use real animals for all this stuff. And if you want to see the pinnacle of that, go check out a movie called Roar, where most of the cast was mauled by lions during the production of the film. I'm not kidding. Go see Roar. This, I can pass. It's not even a stream it for
it's
me.
It's a stream it only because, like, I could see... like watching this with my nieces, maybe.
I can't reward this, and Jack London deserves better. Next up is Brahms, The Boy 2. Did you see The Boy, Shay? I know you like the horror films.
I did not. I actually was going to, like, this is how much I was going to ask, like, if this was that thing where they're, like, trying to be interesting by, like, saying 2.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Do you like the creepy doll horror movies?
I'm not, that's the thing, is I'm not a creepy, yeah. I've never been a creepy doll one.
This is not the Annabelle universe. I will say that some of the Child's Play movies are a lot of fun. If you just go in and check your brain out and you're like,
in being like, this is going to be stupid.
Yeah, and it is. This is a sequel to The Boy, which was a film about a serial killer who had possessed a house and was trying to kill the family through the boy and created this doll that was an avatar for the boy. In this film, the doll apparently is the source of the evil, and the boy finds it and, I guess, wants to kill his family. We've seen this before.
Yeah.
And I really have no desire to see any more of it.
No.
Hard skip for me.
Big ol' skip.
Next up.
Big ol' skip.
Next up, Emma. Because the world needs more Jane Austen adaptations, this is the latest adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma. This one actually, in addition to not having Gwyneth Paltrow in it, that's the version that my generation is going to recognize. Directed by Autumn de Wilde, written by Eleanor Cart, adapted by Eleanor Catton, I should say. So you've got women responsible for this. This one's got Bill Nighy in it. And anytime you put him in something, it immediately goes up several levels in my book because he is one of the finest and most hilarious British actors working today. So if you're going to tell me that it is a dry and quirky reimagining of Jane Austen, I'm kind of in for that. Plus, this thing looks sumptuous. And I believe we have an early contender for Academy Awards for costume design and production design. So I've got a couple of reasons there why you should see it.
I'm going to go stream it on this one for all the reasons that you said see it. I mean, for me, I'm not really period pieces person very much anyways. And I mean, for the same reason that I didn't feel like seeing Little Women, you know, it was just like, to me, the Gwyneth Paltrow Emma is always going to be Emma, you know? But it does, I mean, it does, I agree, like, just the production value of it does look very
good. Yeah, it looks like, and the thing is, you know, it's the English doing the English, so it's not, you
I was going to say, that's the other thing, is that it is actually English people doing it.
Yeah, and those films usually...
It's like how Irish people can really lean into making fun of Irish people.
The best advice I could give is, if you enjoyed The Favourite, and you loved The Favourite, you're probably going to love this and should go see this. if you like English costume drama, obviously you should go see this. I think Call the Midwife is in repeats anyway. The other new film that we have this week is Seaberg. And this is an interesting little piece here. This is a film about the French New Wave actress Jane Seaberg, who during the height of the civil rights movement was dating and very heavily involved with one of the leaders of the Black Power movement, and found herself subject to a tremendous amount of harassment at the hands of the FBI. So this is allegedly telling that story. Critics have not been kind to this film, and Kristen Stewart is here. I kind of check out whenever I see Kristen Stewart. There is something about her and the way that she plays characters that I just always see Kristen Stewart, and I'm like, yeah, it's really not working for me.
Nah.
You've also got Anthony Mackie here, who's very good. Vince Vaughn is in this. Colm Meaney, who, you know, we haven't seen him since Star Trek, have we? He's in this. If you like the historical drama, maybe you're into this. It illustrates a lesser-known story from the civil rights struggle, but the consensus is it does it on a very bland and superficial level. So if you're looking to maybe learn a bit of history you didn't know it's there.
I would say that's like everything I've read. This is a hard pass for me. Like you said, the minute I hear Kristen Stewart, I'm like, nope. But also, all the reviews that I've read of it thus far have said, and I know the Seaberg story, you know what I mean? Like, it's a really interesting piece of history, and they say it really just glosses over, like, it takes this really great subject matter that hasn't really been done and just kind of just doesn't do it justice.
So that's a skip on Seaberg.